people power. What's the essence of this power? So we'll try to find that in some of these stories and enter into a discussion about it.
So as we tell the stories, see if what emerges in terms of themes for you. The year is 1942, and Hitler has just invaded Norway. And as you all probably remember, he imposed a puppet government, and who was at the head? Quisling. Remember Quisling? That's a name that we remember to part of Madison, actually. Quisling had this idea that he really wanted to make certain that Nazi values were really embedded in the culture of Norway, and he was going to win the hearts and the minds of the children. And so one of his first acts was to establish a Nazi teachers' union and was to impose a Nazi curriculum for this propaganda curriculum that they were to teach in the schools. Well, the Norwegian underground immediately clicked into gear, and they were appalled at this, and they organized. And out of the 10,000 teachers in Norway then, 8,000 signed their name to a letter to Quisling saying they would never join a Nazi teacher union and they would never teach the curriculum. Well, they not only signed their names, but they put their addresses. So that was a very dangerous thing to do. Quisling was furious, of course, you can imagine, and he threatened to close all the schools. And the teachers said, we'll teach in our homes. And so they actually began to pull the children out of the schools and teach them in their homes. Well, this went on, this resistance continued, and Quisling got even more furious. And so then he had 1,000 of the male teachers, some of the leadership, arrested, put on cattle cars, and sent to a concentration camp in the north of Norway around the Arctic Circle. And as the story goes, as this train filled with teachers wove its way through the fjords of Norway, people would come to the station, whether it was daytime, nighttime, whatever. Families would come, children would come with their parents, and they had flowers. They would sing songs. And they all had a secret symbol of solidarity, a paperclip. And they wore it on their shirts, their coats, their lapels. And it was a silent way of saying, we're going to stick together. We're with you. The teachers were met with Gestapo tactics there. They were made to do torture gymnastics in the snow. They were fed starvation rations. And this became, there was rumors that they were going to be killed. At one point, the wives were approached, the wives whose husbands had been sent away. And they said, what should we do? Who are we to think we could take on the Third Reich? This is we've made a terrible mistake. But the women stood in solidarity. They said, if our husbands are dead, we don't know. They may be dead, they may not be dead, but we can't be sure, so the cause for which they have been sacrificed, we can never sacrifice. We can never compromise. And so the resistance continued and continued. At one point, there was a meeting of the teachers' union in Oslo, not the Nazi teachers' union, but the real teachers' union, and Quisling came into that meeting. And as was told, he yelled at this group and said, to teachers, you had ruined everything for me. Because he realized they were not going to quit and they were not going to give in. And this initial failure was one of the reasons that he could never Nazify Norway. And those teachers are held up as real heroes. And 8 months later, they just about all of them came home to heroes welcome all throughout Norway. A wonderful story that we don't know about. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. When we finish a couple of these stories, I'm going to ask you to give your thoughts in terms of what common themes do you see in terms of the question of what is nonviolent power. The year is 1980, and in the Lenin shipyards in the north of Poland, Gdansk, on the Baltic Sea, the workers have decided to go on strike. Now, this happened many times before in the 1960s and the 70s, but in those days, the Polish workers tended to be incited to riot. One time, they burned down the Communist Party headquarters, and another time, they were fired upon by soldiers, and it turned violent. But in this particular one, 1980, led by an electrician named Lech Wałęsa, they decided to occupy the shipyards, to actually live in the shipyards, to prevent scab workers from coming in and taking over, and to pledge themselves to nonviolence. Lech Walesa was somewhat familiar with the work of Gandhi, but even more importantly, he was a very—he was a practicing Catholic. He was believed that Jesus' way, the third way, between passivity and violence, was nonviolent action. He was also kind of a charismatic speaker. So the workers occupied the Lenin shipyards, shut it down. After various attempts to negotiate, the strike began to spread across northern Poland and then throughout the entire Polish country. And other groups joined in. Previously, the workers had tended to be somewhat isolated from the intellectuals. But in this particular moment, because of the work of a group called KOR, Workers' Defense Committee, led by Adam Michnik, who was a professor of philosophy and history, and very sympathetic to the workers, the intellectuals and the students joined in a sympathy strike. And they also brought in representatives of the church, some of the priests who were familiar with the social teachings of the church. So they're kind of a coalition of the church, the workers, and the intellectuals. And this is one of the reasons why eventually it became called Solidarność, or solidarity. It was for the first time maybe in Polish history that these three groups had united around a series of principles. First and foremost was the idea of a free trade union, a trade union independent of the Communist Party. But along with that went a lot of other things, attempts at, you know, demanding freedom of speech and freedom of press, of course higher wages and better working conditions. The strike went on for months. There was a great deal of difficulty, but as it gained momentum throughout the country, the Communist Party realized they had to deal with it somehow, and they made some concessions, particularly the idea of a free trade union. And once this step was made, something amazing happened. Recruiting drive to join the Solidarity Union spread like wildfire, and within 8 months, they had 10 million members. How's that for a recruiting or a organization? 10 million members in less than a year. Obviously, it met a pent-up need and a passion that had been suppressed for a long time. It spread so rapidly, and the demands began to escalate against the Communist Party, that 18 months later, partly pressured by Moscow and partly, you know, fear of being overthrown, General Jaruzelski, the Polish leader at the time, suddenly declared martial law and, under cover of night, arrested many of the leaders of the Solidarity Union. At this point, many commentators in the West thought, well, it's all over. It shows that nonviolence can be crushed by military power. And indeed, to the outsider, it somewhat looked that way. Jane and I were fortunate enough, we spent, during the 1980s, 2 summers teaching in Krakow, Poland. And one of the things we discovered was Solidarity had gone underground. We visited churches, and there would be Solidarity banners down in the basement. And one evening when we were sitting around singing with our Polish students, they wanted to sing Solidarity Forever. And as we played and sang it, one of the students went over and opened up the windows so that it rang out into the courtyard, even though the school itself was sponsored by the Communist Party. So the movement was not crushed. It took a different form. In 1989, it began to come back up out of the underground. There were some reasons, a number of reasons for this. It had grown in strength, but also a new change of regime in Moscow. Mr. Gorbachev had come in, and the Gorbachev doctrine was that Russian tanks and army would no longer be used in Eastern Europe. Remember previously when there had been freedom movements in East Germany in 1953, and Hungary in 1956, and in Czechoslovakia in 1968, the fraternal allies, the Warsaw Pact forces, would come in and crush the uprisings with the great bloodbath. Well, once the Gorbachev Doctrine came into being, Solidarity Movement came up. and made very forceful demands. The ordinary soldiers and police themselves often refused to follow orders to crush the strikes, the demonstrations. And at that point, Jaruzelski was forced to allow for free elections, and he was shocked when, you know, something like 95% of the electorate voted for solidarity. And that was the beginning of the overthrow of communism throughout all of Eastern Europe. And it was a relatively bloodless coup, a relatively bloodless people power movement. And far more powerful than all of the weapons of NATO, who didn't really free one square inch of Eastern Europe.
Okay. Going now to the United States and the civil rights movement, but a story that you may not have heard of. It was in the spring of 1963, and it's in Birmingham. Now, Birmingham had become a place for a lot of activity because the African-American community there had decided that they wanted to march through downtown Birmingham as a protest because of the segregated businesses there. Even though they used those businesses a lot, they never had any salespeople there, any waitresses at the restaurants. And so they said, it's time. We want to see our own people there in those businesses. And so the marches began. They marched many, many, many days, and Martin Luther King was actually arrested in Birmingham, and there's a famous letter from Birmingham jail. Hundreds of people were in jail by the end of April 1963. And some of Martin Luther King's followers had gone into the high schools to talk to the youth there about the importance of what was going on in downtown Birmingham, and did they realize that this was an important struggle, and this was a struggle for their freedom as well. Well, the youth got very excited, and as the numbers began to dwindle because so many people were in jail, the youth decided, we're going to take up the marches. Well, as dangerous as this was, this happened. Some of the high school students actually brought their younger siblings, and there were children as young as 7 in some of these marches. So the day came when they had decided they were going to march, and like their parents and their grandparents, they met in the church, and they would sing and pray together, and then they would start walking 2 by 2, silently, nonviolently, down the main street of Birmingham. Do you remember the sheriff of Birmingham? Bull Connor.
Yes.
Bull Connor. And so, as the children marched, he saw them coming, and he was ready. He had his policemen lined up, and he said, get those children. And so the police were turned loose, and they chased the children, and out of the 1,000 children that marched that day, 900 were arrested and sent to jail. So the next day, 2,500 children gathered in the church, and they were going to continue the march. And so again, they sang together, they prayed together, and then did this marching nonviolently downtown. Well, this time, Will Connor was really ready. He'd had enough. And so he had set up a barricade of firemen with fire hoses and of policemen with dogs, guard dogs, attack dogs. And so as the children came toward him, you could hear him yell, turn loose those dogs, turn on the hoses. And many of you must remember those terrible pictures of that year, of that day, where children were blown across the street and thrown into trees and into buildings, and dogs ripped the flesh of children, and some were very seriously injured. There were lots of reporters there that day and lots of TV cameras, and those scenes were sent all over the United States, all over the world. And that day, according to King, is when, especially in the North, people began to awaken to the severity of racism in the South and what was going on. So the next day came. Now, the next day was Sunday, and the children, under the leadership of Reverend Billups, had wanted to go and be with their parents and their family members who were in jail. So their plan was, again, to do the march, but to also end up at the jail so they could have a prayer vigil there with their parents. Well, again, the children gathered to sing and to pray and then to march together downtown to Birmingham. And again, Bull Connor was ready with his guard dogs and his firemen with their hoses. And Reverend Billups did something very spontaneously. As he saw the barricade there, as the children approached, he said, "Let us kneel and pray." And so they knelt and prayed, and Reverend Billups said, "I'm praying for the safety of these children. I'm praying for our freedom. But I'm also praying for those men that face us now. May their hearts be softened, and may they hear our cry. We are not going to go away. We have done nothing wrong. We will match their ability to inflict violence by our ability to endure violence. We'll match their physical force by soul force." And then he rose, and the children began to march through this line to the barricade. And Martin Luther King was out of jail by that time, and he observed this march. He had decided this was a march for the people of Birmingham, and he wouldn't lead this march. But he watched, and he said it was as if a miracle happened, like the parting of the Red Seas, that the policemen and the firemen stepped aside, even though Bull Connor was again yelling, "Turn loose those dogs, turn on those hoses," no one responded. And in fact, Martin Luther King said that there were tears in the eyes of some of the men that day. He also, looking back, said that was the purest form of nonviolent soul power he had ever seen. And for him, it was a turning point in the civil rights movement, the Birmingham Children's March.
In the mid-19th century, Hungary was trying to establish some autonomy from Austria, and they were united in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And initially, there were some pitched battles, and the Hungarian cavalry were pretty much defeated by the larger Austrian army. At that point, the Austrian army occupied Hungary, and it looked as if it had become a defeated nation. A Catholic nobleman by the name of Ferenc Diák, however, kind of rose up. He was a legal scholar, and he said, "We've been defeated militarily, but it doesn't mean we have to be defeated in our spirit. And we should resist on the basis of law. And so we won't obey any laws except the laws that our own Hungarian parliament had put forward." So that when the Austrians came, for example, to extract taxes, there was massive tax resistance, and people refused to pay those taxes in Hungary. The Austrian army then, of course, went in and confiscated people's goods in lieu of their taxes. And then they tried to sell them at auction. But, of course, no Hungarian would buy contaminated goods stolen from their neighbors. Or they would use the famous penny sale, where you buy back, you know, things at a few cents and give them back to the neighbors from whom they had been confiscated. At that point, the army was ordered to take these massive amounts of goods back to Austria and to auction them off there. But even the Austrian people began to feel somewhat shamed by this whole thing, wondering why are we taking our neighbors' living room and kitchen furnishings? Why are we stealing them from our neighbors? Because the Austrian army was not being physically attacked, but resisted nonviolently, the resistance got a certain amount of credence, credibility, and sympathy, even in Austria. The Hungarians also created kind of a whole alternative society, a set of underground schools. Of course, the churches were very active in the resistance, an underground parliament, and to show that they would not knuckle under to sheer force. The Austrian general in charge of the army of occupation began to notice that his troops were become very demoralized. They were trained to fight other soldiers. They were not trained to fight civilians and to become, in the words of one, used furniture salesmen. And they felt that there was something rather shameful about what they were doing, terrorizing their neighbors. And there was large-scale desertions, in fact, from the Austrian army at this point, to the point where the Austrian general wrote back to Emperor Franz Joseph, "My army is being defeated without a shot being fired." One of the more dramatic statements in the history of military warfare. The struggle went on for a number of years, and not to get into too many details. Finally, Franz Josef, it became, so unpopular within his own country that he decided he needed to negotiate. He invited Ferenc Diak to come to Vienna to speak with him, and Diak had a lot of guts. He said he would not come unless the emperor first guaranteed the autonomy of the Hungarian parliament. And he said, if you do so, we may choose to elect you king, also king of Hungary. And Franz Josef, to his credit, accepted this. And something was worked out where the Hungarians got their constitution, they got their own parliament, and then it just so happened that the emperor of Austria was also elected king of Hungary. One of the more brilliant solutions to political conflict.
In the late, let's see, it was 1989 and 1990, Vince and I had the privilege of going to Jerusalem and Palestine in the midst of the First Intifada. And it was very interesting there to see the power of nonviolence in pockets. And one of the groups that so impressed me were the women in black, who had organized against the occupation, the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And these women, once a week, all dressed in black, would stand on prominent intersections in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and hold up signs, a black hand, in white lettering, stop the occupation, and it was in English, Arabic, and Hebrew. And I had the privilege of standing with these women, and it was pretty amazing because tensions were very, very high then. I think all of us, and most of us have been in a vigil before, in a protest, but I had never felt the backlash that I did that those women were receiving. Things were just too hot. It was just too controversial. And they stood steadfast in silent vigil once a week. And I was amazed. There was a counter demonstration going on across the street, and people screaming all kinds of things at them. There were other, even a bus of school children came by, and some of them threw their lunch bags out the window at them. And to think, I was just talking to Andrea Musher to see if she thinks this group is still going on. I mean, it's a vigil that they have kept. And now the movement has spread, at least. When we were there, it was spreading. It was spreading into the countryside, and women from the kibbutz were coming out to the highways and also at the same time having a vigil. So all over Israel, there were these women witnessing against the occupation. It was a very moving thing and a very brave thing to do. On the other side we saw other examples of nonviolence, but one was a Sunday morning. We were had heard that there was a Quaker meeting in Ramallah, actually over 100 years old. There's been a Quaker meeting in Ramallah. So we thought, well, now we're here, and why don't we see what this is like? And so we got a taxi and went there, and when we got there, it was Sunday morning, but Sunday morning in the Arab world is not a holy day. Their holy day is Friday, so businesses were open and life was going on as we would think of as kind of the weekday. But shortly after we got there, we saw the shopkeepers starting to roll down their metal doors, which is how they would shut their shops. And you could just feel the tension in the air. And sure enough, children started throwing rocks, and then a helicopter came, and then there were some Israeli soldiers ready to fire on these children with rubber bullets. And it was just this moment. We were very close to the action, and I'd never been that close to anyone firing guns, and I was pretty naive, and I was pretty shaken. But we found the Quaker meeting, we knocked on the door, and we said, should we come in, because we don't want in any way to jeopardize you by our presence here. And there was a woman about 5 feet tall, Ellen Mansour, a powerhouse of a woman, who said, no, the soldiers have no business here. They're not coming in. She said, you come in and be with us. And I thought, and then I looked, and she was running a Sunday school class. And I thought, oh, those poor children, they must be terrified. I'll go and sit with them. Well, there was this center of calm. They were looking, there was in the middle was a peace rose, a beautiful peace rose, a kind of peach and yellow. It was in the middle, and the children were sitting around, and they were singing. And they were very relaxed and very centered and adoring this woman. And the song that she was teaching them was, be careful what you do with your hands, be careful what you do with your hands. There is someone up above that is looking down with love. Be careful what you do with your hands. And then be careful what you do with your mouth. Be careful what you do. A song about living mindfully. And it was just this wonderful moment. It's frozen in time. And when I think of Israel and Palestine, these women are in juxtaposition. The women in black and Ellen Mansour, all working in their own way to bring about peace in that area of the world. But then I have one last story, and this comes from our sister city in Arkatau. In the early 90s, there were five of us from Madison who went to visit Arkatau. It was part of a national sister city reunion or conference. And we were going because we had been called by the sister cities, especially our city, Arkatau, to verify the violations of the peace accords. The peace accords had been signed months before, but American helicopters were being used to strafe villagers as they brought in the harvest. And people who were trying to leave Arkatau, which is a little village in the mountains, to evacuate children who were ill or elderly, were being harassed by soldiers on the road, and some of them died. And so they wanted members of their sister city to come and document this and take this story back, because it was their way of getting support from us. And so we were there doing that. The last day we were in Arkatau, after spending about 3 or 4 days there and talking to the women's cooperatives and the agricultural cooperatives, and we met with the teachers, and we were gathering lots of documentation, and I suddenly realized, I wonder who was on the pastoral team, because these were the days when, if you were a part of the liberation theology movement, you were targeted by the death squads. And when I asked the woman who's coordinating our trip if anybody had ever visited the pastoral team in Arkatau, they said no, they'd never visited them. So then I was really interested to see who would do this, because if you were willing to do that, you were really putting your life on the line. And so I remember climbing the steps of the church and looking way down in the front. It was one of the few buildings that hadn't been bombed out. It was a very simple structure, but I looked in the front where there was a circle of people, and I found a group of gray-haired women, which was very interesting. And there was one man, probably in his 40s, maybe 50s, but basically they were grandmothers, women who had lost their husbands, their sons, their daughters, their family, and yet they were so committed to working, to being lay ministers in this parish. They continued their work, and they talked about what they had done. They organized peace marches to San Salvador. They did all kinds of trying to get food for the poor, and they would go out into the villages, which also was a dangerous thing, sometimes just to make sure that they were being served. Those little village parishes were being served. Although our Arkatau is not very big itself, but the hamlets are even smaller. So at the end, I said to the women, because they were still living under the threat of death squads, what keeps you going? What keeps you doing this day after day after day? You've lost so much. Your lives are at such risk. What keeps you going? And this one woman became the spokesperson for the group, and she said one of the most profound statements I have ever heard, and this came from a campesina woman in the hills of El Salvador. She said, I keep asking myself, what should I be doing in this moment of history?
Nonviolent power is often described as a spiritual force, but it also has strategies. And Jane has a handout we're going to look at in terms of some of the strategies that peace movements and justice movements have utilized throughout history, in the stories that we've told, and the many more that we haven't. Practical nonviolent action is based on the insight that political power drives not directly from rulers, but from the consent and cooperation, however grudgingly, of the ruled. Okay, strategies of nonviolent resistance we're looking at here. Therefore, the withdrawal of cooperation, of people's cooperation with the ruler, is the key to nonviolent strategy. Professor Gene Sharp has, he's detailed over 200 different strategies. We won't go over all of those. But there's three main categories. And the first category is protest and persuasion. And this is one I'm sure you've all utilized. Everything from writing letters and petitions, lobbying, leaflets, vigils. Mostly legal activities within a democracy. Declarations, protest meetings, festivals like today. The next one up is nonviolent non-cooperation. And here we enter into perhaps a higher level of resistance. Boycotts. Some of you remember the boycott on grapes and the boycott on sweatshop items. And there's quite a few going on today. Tax refusal. Refusal to pay for war. Various kinds of strikes. And, of course, civil disobedience, which was utilized by the Solidarity people, the Hungarian resistors, the civil rights marchers, and so forth. And then finally, the perhaps the most radical level of nonviolent resistance, which most movements perhaps never get to, nonviolent intervention, when the nonviolent resistors actually try to create an alternative institution through sit-ins, prayer-ins, land seizures, alternative markets, ride-ins, nonviolent occupations, alternative social institutions, very important, and even finally, parallel government. Here they often draw on what are called civil society, those kind of open, free spaces outside of government, outside of the corporate world, like churches and fraternal organizations, peace organizations, and so forth and so on.
One of the things we thought we would do at this point is kind of open up to all of you. And what, you know, one of the important things about keeping telling these stories is that's how nonviolence is going to seem relevant in today's world. And so what stories do you know about nonviolent resistance that's going on today or that you grew up with? Or what are stories that you know that are dear to you?
Well, the one that immediately comes after this distinction between the three different levels of nonviolent non-cooperation was when I lived in Germany, the German women's movement, which I was involved with, had much less wiggle room than our women's movement here. So I had just come from a place where we had started the Rape Crisis Center, that there was the beginnings of the Shelter for Domestic Violence, Shelter for Battered Women. And that, in a government like Germany's, which was much more top-down, which had a much more secure, what has been called since Reagan, a safety net, where people really didn't fall through the cracks to the extent that they do in this country, which is the positive side. There also wasn't the wiggle room to create alternate institutions. So I was able to see, the pros and the cons of those different situations. And, I think that those were two very important interventions on the part of the women's movement against violence against women, those two alternate institutions.
Kind of breaking that conspiracy of silence. And also at that point we were talking about sexual abuse. It was for a long time that was not talked about, or there weren't ways to deal with that.
I think of all of the neighbor-to-neighbor things and really strong peace movements that are going on in Israel in particular, that I'm more aware of that than some of the others probably, that never get into the news. And how the whole, those sorts of stories and their effectiveness just don't ever get to us. And I was just so touched hearing the stories you gave us, because that too is, it's hidden history, but this is going on right now too. I think of there are just so many people I've worked with and talked with who are doing that sort of thing. Eliyahu McLean, Nevi Shalom Ohad al-Salam, Thich Nhat Hanh working with Palestinians and Jews, the multi-diplomacy,
Louise Diamond.
Pardon me, Louise Diamond and, and John McDonald, multi-track diplomacy. And it's just one thing after another. The Mosaic, the apartment building with Jews and Palestinians together. They're all kinds of things. And we don't hear about them. Even the Israelis sometimes don't hear about them in their own country. Although this summer, or last May, when I was talking with two women, one of whom lives at Neve Shalom, I can't remember if Samia also lives there, but and Dorit said, we should be giving you more support. It's less okay in the United States to protest what's going on here than it is here. We have more freedom than you do. Well, I'm a Jew, and I know what she was talking about. It's not okay in my community. It is okay in my community, because I'm in Shiree Shemayim, and we listen to everybody. But it's not okay in the Jewish community. You're, you're really seen as... not being with the people, as it were, not being with the tribe. But I'm sure that those things are going on in many, many places that I don't know about.
I know. Sorry. And that's part of the problem, is we don't know about it. In fact, you reminded me, we were there doing one of the Intifada, as I said, and it was very tense. But we heard just a couple of human interest stories which were just very sweet. And one was they would impose curfews. The Israelis would impose curfews, and that meant, you know, that families, the Palestinian families, could not leave their homes. So sometimes they didn't have water or food and got pretty desperate. And there were stories of Israeli soldiers who would walk by a house and put their hands behind their back and signal to the Palestinian they could leave their house, that it was safe. You know, that kind of solidarity across lines you wouldn't expect. And then there was also a story of one cold day when there were a group of Israeli soldiers standing over, they lit a garbage can on fire with paper and trash because their hands were so cold, and a Palestinian mother brought bowls of soup for them. It's like, those are the stories that keep us going. Those are part of that narrative that was talked about this morning.
Other people have examples?
Yeah, I wanted to share a story that was powerful to me when I was young.
Oh,
I grew up in Miami, Florida. I think went to Raleigh, North Carolina as an undergraduate, probably 59, 60, somewhere around there. And it was a fully segregated area. I mean, you would see, okay, here's colored bathrooms, here's whites, colored, had to go in the back of et cetera. The movie theaters, right. It was just the common way.
That's right.
And during a session of the United Nations, it turned out one of the African ambassadors got her degree at Shaw University, which is now a historical black school in Brooklyn. And she came down to visit and was rejected. And I'm not sure, I don't remember any student movement, but there was embarrassment, at least in the university. And the Raleigh Times, almost the next day, came out with an article saying, we will publish any name of any person who will go to restaurants that integrate. I remember there was page after page after page, and it totally collapsed. And within a couple years, they had put together the black schools and the white schools, so it just happened overnight. And I was sort of an observer, but it was just showing me the power of if people want to think. But this required the authorities, or at least the newspaper, taking this whole. The rest of North Carolina was just like the South. It took years for those parts to. So I've always had this contrast in my life, how cleanly people can make a change if they're given a chance to express themselves.
It was sort of in the air then. 1960 was the period of the great student sit-ins in Woolworths and Nashville and many of the other towns in the South, and it began to spread by example, and like wildfire. This sounds a little earlier. This sounds a little bit earlier.
Well, when I went there, it was Eisenhower administration.
Yeah.
And I can't remember which year this happened, but I just, and there wasn't lunch counter sit-ins. It was just the embarrassment to the community.
Just the embarrassment.
And
mm-hmm.
the community responding to it, mm-hmm. getting such support. That
interesting.
It's always sat with me as something just amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
It reminds me of Vincent mentioned Adam Michnik as part of the Solidarity Movement, and he was a Jewish intellectual in Poland. And he said something that sort of caught fire in Poland. It was, act as if you were free and you are free. And I remember on the plane going over, we were taking our children with us that when we were teaching, and we were saying, now you're going behind the Iron Curtain. This was, you know, you have to be careful and quiet. And we got to Poland, and people on the streetcars were talking about the occupation and the coffee shops. I mean, we were flabbergasted. And it was like Adam Michnik's sort of challenge, act as if you are free and you are free. A wonderful, fascinating mm-hmm. man.
Speaks to the overcoming of fear,
yes.
not living in fear,
yes.
that we've been talking about.
Uh-huh.
Other examples?
Yes. This isn't a personal example, but I just finished reading the autobiography of Queen Noor, the American woman who married the King
yeah.
of Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously I was getting a one-sided view, but from what she wrote, her husband, King Hussein, was an amazing man. He did so much to foster peace in the Middle East, mm-hmm. and he took great risks in doing so. It was incredible. There was one point at which a Jordanian soldier gunned down 7 Israeli school children, and of course that was just a horrible thing, and he was absolutely devastated, and he went to Israel to each of the families who had lost a child and brought the TV cameras with him. And he knew he was going to get in trouble in his country because there were people mm-hmm. who were very, very much against him because he mm-hmm. you know, wasn't talking the talk now. And he said, I want the world to see that, you know, what I'm doing. And he didn't do it to show off or anything, but he did it to show that, you know, there's a better way to live. And that man was just remarkable. Mm. Yeah.
Thank you. Other examples or insights? Thank you.
Your story about the woman in black reminded me, and I have a friend in Eau Claire, because I live there from the Unitarian Church, and they had a group there, I don't know if it went beyond the Unitarians or not, but they would dress in black and stand on the street corner at least once a week and have a stop the war sign and how much, really, a lot, some support, but a lot of really verbal abuse would go, you know, right mm-hmm. right. They deliver a lot of mm-hmm. heat stuff. They went out every day dressed up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you could, just standing next to each other can give you such a sense of security and solidarity. It's mm-hmm. hard to do it alone.
Other comments, insights into the nature of nonviolent power or examples that you'd like to share?
Well, I think the other thing that was quite clear from every story that you told was it wasn't individuals. Mm-hmm. It was a whole community response, you know, and the solidarity of the Norwegian mm-hmm. teachers and then the Norwegian populace, the mm-hmm. solidarity of mm-hmm. The solidarity movement that started with the labor movement and then grew, you know, mm-hmm. each one of these were yes. things that were successful because, with the exception of King Hussein, it wasn't just an individual, it was
that's
a
right.
whole response
that's
of
right.
whole groups of people.
They often had strong leaders, but leaders are meaningless unless the community is with them in their principles and their strategies.
And one of, that's an important part of nonviolence. It can be ordinary people doing mm-hmm. extraordinary things. And we tend to think you need a leader to come forth. And I think, especially with the way we educate our children, we sort of name the leaders that, mm-hmm. you know, and if there's not a Gandhi, if there's not a King, if there's not a Rosa Parks, then there must not be... Any,
but Rosa Parks was really just an average person.
That's right, she was.
Well,
she wasn't.
Yeah, yeah. She had actually had some training at the Highlander School, and she was a secretary for the NAACP. But yeah, she was an extraordinary, ordinary person.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, the extraordinary women were behind that movement even before she. Sat on the bus, the women who had organized
mm-hmm.
that.
Joanne Robinson and the Montgomery Women's Association.
They really started the civil rights movement, and you rarely hear of them. Joanna Robinson was an English professor from mm-hmm. the North who got a job in Alabama. and within a few days was told to go on the back of the bus, and she was furious, and she was humiliated, and she said, I am going to work to eliminate this. This is awful. Why do we have to put up with this? And so she worked with the Negro Women's Council, I think it was called, right? And they took 5 years, and they organized the bus boycott. They knew how they were going to do it, because the African Americans were very dependent on the bus. That's how they got across town. That's how they got to work. So these people couldn't lose their jobs. They needed their jobs, but they didn't want them to ride the bus, because they knew the bus company was very dependent upon this ridership.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an amazing feat, and it took a long, long time to do it. And then Martin Luther King came to town. He was kind of the new minister on the block, and they, you know, they knew some of them they could work with, and others they weren't sure. But this guy was new and young and vibrant, and why don't we? And so they recruited. Joanna Robertson was his parishioner, and recruited him to be the spokesperson. Now, see, these are
great.
The stories.
The hidden history.
The hidden history of the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
And then they had arrested a couple of other women on the before Rosa Parks. But if there was anything controversial about them, or if there was anything that they could hold up or whatever, discredit the movement, they let it go. But Rosa Parks, when they got her, they moved. But these women knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
The tragedy is Joanna Robinson lost her job.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So.
No, isn't part of that the ability to bring the media into these?
There
must be a lot of subtle.
Yeah, that's a very important part. Most of what Gandhi wrote actually were newspaper articles. He always published a newsletter or a newspaper. The demonstrations that Jane was talking about in the Civil Rights Movement, like the one in Birmingham, they always made a point to do them in the morning and invite the media so that they could take the film and show it on the 6 o'clock news. And getting the word out is a vital part of, I think, the nonviolent strategy. Because you want to awaken the conscience of the masses of people, those who are not maybe, you know, dead set against you, but they're just not thinking about the issue. They're just kind of sleepwalking through the moral terrain, and they need to be spurred to think about it and to contemplate what's going on. So it's very important to have that kind of publicity.
Have you thought of writing these stories down?
Somebody just asked us that.
We've published some in various sundry places, but it might be a nice idea to have them all together in a little booklet.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
High school kids.
That's true.
Yeah. Other comments? Really?
I don't know how many of you are aware of the situation of the Baha'is in Iran.
Yes, yeah.
Terrible. That's a situation where that exposure to the world media has been the only thing that has been of help at all.
Mm-hmm.
Children are not allowed to go to school. Personal property is confiscated. They've killed, I don't know how many. They put them in jail for trumped up charges, and then, in fact, conflicting charges. They don't make any sense because Baha'is are by religion not partisan politically,
mm-hmm.
and they will be obedient to their government. So
yes.
If the government says you must abandon your institutions, your administrator, they did so and told them, you know, wrote to them and told them, this is what we're doing. You must ask us to do it. We're obedient to government. And then they say, well, you've got to be, you're something else. You know? And it's all based on religion.
Mm-hmm.
They say that, since it's a theocracy, they say that there can't be any religion that started after Muhammad.
Muhammad. Mm-hmm.
And Baha'u'llah came after Muhammad. Mm-hmm. So they say it's a fair game. And, Well, they're just treated very, very badly.
Yes.
Is the Baha'i network, do they respond? I mean, one of the things about today's world is with internet and email and all, that there can be solidarity networks globally, and I'm wondering if Baha'i has that.
The Baha'i community worldwide is very solid, and word gets out. There are people in Iran that get word out to families to the world center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have also been attuned to the persecution.
And what happens is once we look at letters and say, you know, this is the time to write to your congressman or something right. coming up, you know. And so we send out this information, and they get various countries in the world, because Baha'is are just about in every country, so they get all this world pressure and exposure of what's going on, mm-hmm. and then they back off, you know, mm-hmm. then a little bit. So, but we have to keep at it and keep at it and keep at it.
That's right.
They make up the strangest things, because they'll accuse Baha'is of being agents for this, that, or the other government. Often it's Israel, because our world center is there.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Sometimes it has been passed. It's been Russia or Britain or the United States or, you know, anything that they can say. But we can't get involved in politics. So it's the one thing that mm-hmm. they accuse us of. It's impossible. So.
Mm-hmm. Celeste?
I was just going to say about... We're talking about contemporary journalism, which is really important and has actually been one of my hobby horses in the peace movement the last decade. But also I've been learning more and more about people's stories throughout history that, I mean, just through Netflix, I start going through biography and stuff, and I'm going, who are these people, you mm-hmm. know? And I rent a movie, and I go, why don't we know about these people? And more often than not, they're people of color, and I think to myself, okay, half of the reason that people feel strong enough to stand up and say, I have a right, or this is wrong, is because they feel that sense of self-pride. And if you don't know your own people's strength and accomplishments and so on, it takes away the foundation. And so I also am really thinking a lot about the need for our history books and our classrooms and so on to change tremendously. I mean, when I was in the schools, I did little pieces, but mm-hmm. more and more and more, and your stories, and these things need to be
mm-hmm.
there in the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That reminds me of, there's a really interesting movie I was by HBO about women's suffrage here in the US, and the name is escaping me, but I bet it'd be pretty easy to find on Netflix, and all the... Yes, Ironjawed Angels.
What?
Yeah. Ironjawed Angels.
Yeah. Oh, yes, that's a great one.
Yeah.
Sure.
The women's movement.
The women. Oh.
I mean, I consider that the Daily became a democracy.
Yeah. That's a good example.
You can have happy populations subject to laws.
Yeah. Really powerful nonviolent resistance. Yeah.
It's Iron what angels?
Iron jaws.
Iron jaws.
They were forced. They were force fed in prison when they went on the hunger strike.
That reminds me of something that I was thinking of as well, which is a comparison, because I wrote my dissertation about how Nazi propaganda portrayed women.
Mm-hmm.
And what was shocking to me was that there was a group of Nazi women who were essentially, I wouldn't call them feminists, because my idea of feminism does not include anti-Semitism and racism, but they were for their time feminists. They were conservative feminists. And so I read through all of this stuff that they wrote, and some of it was, now I have to admit that at that point in time I really didn't know that much about my own feminist past from the first wave of feminism, but it was like, wow, this is stuff that I thought we figured out in the second wave of feminism, which made me realize how absolutely important it was when I came back here to start the Women's Studies Program, which Andrea and I were both involved in the beginning of the Women's Studies Program here, in order to institutionalize, even though it meant it was going to get shaped by the institution, which was a patriarchal institution, and top-down institution, still, that history, that art, that music, that culture of women's creativity and what women had done was going to be in an institution, so it didn't get lost from the first wave to the second wave, so that when the third wave came along, they could actually build on our shoulders. And I think that is a very important thing too, because this is not a short-term process that we're involved in, and we have to find ways of making sure that what the understandings of the earlier parts of our movement don't get lost and hidden. So ways of making sure that they get into the institutions, however squished and shaped by those institutions, I think is very important.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'd like to add to that.
Mm-hmm.
We're coming
Oh, we have to end. Okay.
I think,
I'm not watching your time.
Go ahead. What did you want to say?
That right now, one of the big things that's going on in all around the world is that people are supporting women to come into power more because, and this is about the peace movement, because the women come into power and they don't want their children killed.
Right? That's right.
Yeah. That was it.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're going to close with a short poem called Redemption.
How is the pain of the world made bearable?
How is the guilty soul made sound?
How is the land, a people's land, saved from lies?
Not in armies, not in power, not in wealth, though it roll round our necks like the sea.
The world is redeemed when the tears of an Afghan girl flow down the cheeks of a well-armed soldier.
When the Iranian doctor teaches an Israeli student.
When a Mexican peasant feeds us with dignity.
When an American student opens heart and mind to the wounds of our world.
We break the silence together and begin to build the world.
We share the child's laughter and our lives lift lightly.
We hold each other in the sorrow of the world and are cleansed.
Thank you.
Thank you.